This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by FRP Games, where overstock discounts run all the way up to 90% off. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, I'm James Wyatt, one of the lead designers for 4th edition and author of Eberron Trilogy, The Draconic Prophecies, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 137. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to examine the conflict between magic, technology, chaos, order, good, evil, fluff, crunch, with a review of the campaign setting Amethyst. And in this episode, I am joined by Quinn Murphy from the At Will blog. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we also have Tracy Hurley from Sarah Dark Magic, and welcome to you, too.
Thanks.
It's always good to have some familiar faces and or voices, I should say, and give Tracy a chance to practice her microphone skills a little bit. We're going to be doing the initial sort of review as we look through this book. And then we'll be going over to an interview that I'm going to be doing later tonight as we're recording with the author of the book and creator of the setting. So we'll get to get his take on the whole thing. Now, real quick, in terms of D&D news, I don't know that there's much that's new. I think I mentioned last episode where we talked about news that if you want a preview of Dark Sun, the Wednesday Encounters program is doing a Dark Sun series of adventures right now. Beyond that, I don't know what else, anything else going on in the world of D&D that people should know about?
For anyone who's been following on At Will, I just edited and reposted up the new version of the Worldbreaker solo rules. If you haven't seen it, it's basically sort of a way of expanding what you're doing with solos. Is something I'm pretty excited about, and it's sort of going to segue into, I actually have a few more solo concepts that I'm going to roll out, and this is the first of two, maybe three. I'm not sure about the third one, definitely the second one, so might be something you want to check out.
Yeah, and I've really enjoyed using the Worldbreaker, and I know I haven't in some of the ones I've designed, I don't know that I've embraced the full concept of breaking the world when I do it, but there are some elements of it that I've wholeheartedly embraced, and now anytime I make a solo, I always keep those ideas in mind.
That's awesome. Yeah,
they've been good. I guess in other news and stuff that I've got going on, I have just this week, as we're recording, launched a new website, temporaryhitpoints.com. I kind of looked at all the blogs that were out there, and there was a ton of things out there for 4th edition DMs, a ton of sort of general gaming, but very little out there specifically for players. So much like the motivation that led me to start this podcast, I decided to fill the gap. The site will update weekly at a minimum. It could go more if we have more articles and more guests that want to contribute. And like I just implied, it will be articles from myself and for guests. Guest writers. Including,
what guests do you have contributing?
Including the two people we have on tonight.
Hey.
As well as a few others that I've lined up. So we should have some fantastic guest writing for the Temporary Hit Points website. And it's all about 4th edition players. 4th edition D&D players, check it out. TemporaryHitPoints.com. Does that cover all?
Yeah,
the
it definitely.
Go ahead.
Oh, it definitely fills a really good niche there. You sort of surmised it wisely there that there's nothing really there in that space. So I think it'll be really really, really pretty awesome to see there. So,
well, and I think it's legitimate to have a lot of focus on DMs because I think DMs need more help. You know, they've got a lot going on in terms of story design and monster design and encounter. There's just a lot going on for a DM to deal with. But at the same time, there's a lot more players than there are DMs. So I figured there was something there to look at.
Mm-hmm. DMs are also the most important people in the universe.
Right. Well, yes. A DM is a fantastic way to have a game, isn't it? One DM and no players?
Yeah.
That goes well. All right. Well, tonight we're going to look at the campaign setting Amethyst, created by Chris Diaz and published by Goodman Games in its hardback format. It's a monster of a book. It's about over 250 pages and smaller than typical font size. So, I guess I should say, it's really a campaign setting that in many ways is meant to focus on the competition between technology and magic in a odd sort of blend. But we're going to get into that in some more detail in just a bit. Before I do, I want to talk about our sponsor. That is FRP Games. I've been picking things for dice lately, and in this episode, I'm going to continue in that theme. I could pick Amethyst, which, you know, I'm going to link to as well. But dice are fun, and they offer some cool stuff over at FRP Games. This time, I'm picking the Black Leather Elven Script Dice Cup from Q Workshop. Q Workshop makes some fantastic dice, and the Elven Script looks really cool, especially with the silver lettering on this black leather cup. It's just really a standout, cool little thing. And it's currently less than $20, which is 20% off the normal price. You can check it out at thetomeshow.com and find a link to this product, as well as FRP Games, where they have that and so much more.
FRP Games is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% off all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Through our website, you'll be directed to their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or you can even buy your special gaming someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and for 10 years has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit our website for instant access to FRP Games inventory of thousands of unique gaming items.
All right, it's time to get to the review and give Tracy a chance to say something.
Something.
There you go. All right, so we've got a handful of questions we're going to answer. We're going to go through what is Amethyst, what does the book provide, and what does it do well, and what do we maybe think it could have done better. To quickly summarize what is Amethyst, because we want to not go too horribly long, I've worked up a little summary here. Amethyst is a setting set in the far future of the Earth that we all live on. Some sort of massive event has happened ages ago to bring magic and fey creatures back into the world, and it turns out that the magic disrupts technology and makes it useless. There continue to be bastions of technology in the world still, although some humans have joined the magical or Ekin world. Along with this event, two gates also appeared in the world, one called Atracana, the gate to all things good, chaotic, and free, and one to Ixandar, which is the gate to all things bad, ordered, and controlled. Does that sort of cover what the world is in a nutshell? So, what's in the book? What things do we have of interest in this book? We have rules for using technology in a D&D setting, right? We've got not only normal guns and things like we have today, but even up to, what, lasers and disintegrator rays and that sort of thing, don't we?
Yep.
Yep.
There's a whole slew of new fey races. There's new technology-based classes to use all that technology and all the powers associated with those classes. There's new monsters, and there's lots and lots and lots and lots of info about the people of the world and the world itself. Anything else in the book that people might be interested in knowing that it's there?
I mean, I think the big one, you know, definitely something that the first thing that's going to draw your eye to it is the technology. Like, you know, you got your technology in my D&D game, right? That's the big thing, is the merging of the two. And so that gets pretty extensive treatment in it. So, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing in there. And then everything else fits in, is pretty much as you said.
Okay. So let's go ahead and jump into the next question. This is where I think we're going to start spending a little bit more time discussing is... What do we like about the book? What's good in the book? Let's start with that before we get into what we may have liked to see different. So, Tracy, what do you like about the book?
I like the classes. They seem to evoke right away what they're trying to go for with the operator class and the things like that that seem to be missing a bit from regular D&D books. There aren't a lot of specializations that seem quite that evocative. Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing I liked from it.
Quinn, what's something you liked in the book?
I mean, I like I already gave myself away, right? And as I was talking about the technology, I think I like the concept of mixing the two. I like a lot sort of conceptually in the game, you know, that they sort of introduce these you know, worlds at war sort of colliding together. I think that's the biggest thing that I liked about it is, that it was really interesting. I'd actually been, when I first heard about this, man, I think it's been a while. Cause I remember hearing about that around like Gen Con last year. And I'd been waiting since then. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it doesn't really disappoint on that part conceptually.
Right. You know, I think they did some really interesting things in terms of bringing in technology-based weapons and other mm-hmm. bits, you know, vehicles and that kind of stuff. I think they did fairly well. The artwork, I think, is actually fantastic. I really mm-hmm. like all throughout, and as I understand it, it's the same artist that did all the artwork in the whole book, and I found it to be really, really cool looking all the way through. And
well, they kept him busy.
Yeah, yeah. As I understand it, part of the and I haven't done the interview yet, so maybe we'll find out differently in a bit. But as I understand it from some emails I've exchanged with the author, that the art inspired a lot of what the game ended up being. You know, some of the art came first, and then the world came from it. But we'll see if that's true.
That's cool.
We'll see if that's true in a bit. And I also liked some of the concepts of the setting itself. You know, the idea that you're exploring this conflict, whether it's real or not, between technology and magic. You know, it doesn't necessarily take the mm-hmm. typical approach that fantasy games or settings will do. So I found that really interesting. And there's layers of story elements happening here in the setting, right? There's the technology versus mm-hmm. versus technology or technology versus magic. There's all, which sort of ties into the nature versus, you know, progress sort of discussion in the story. But there's also there's a racial element that comes out in mm-hmm. the whole thing. There's even a religious element that comes out in it. But there's also room for political discussions. And I also found it interesting that and whether it's good or bad, I think there's open to anybody to figure out on their own. But I found it was interesting that they associate chaos with good and law with evil.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Because,
yeah,
because you know, the Atricana, the gate of good, brings about this chaos and the chaotic fae because chaos is all about freedom, you know?
Right.
Whereas order and structure and law are all about taking away freedom and was associated with evil, which is something that 4th edition D&D did the opposite. You know, they didn't...
Right.
With the alignment system, they didn't sort of leave that wiggle room in like they did in previous editions.
Right, yeah. So in standard 4E, chaos is entropy... And sort of the breakdown and law is sort of bringing everything together and is generally implicitly sort of desirable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, any other thoughts on what we like in Amethyst? Because I've got one other thing that I can sort of talk about as I think is a strength of the product and also maybe not a strength of the product, depending on what you're looking for. And that is the depth of content, right? This book is – the content of this book is incredibly dense. I mean, it gives you a lot of information. And I think for somebody just picking up Amethyst for the first time and trying to read through it, it's probably too much information. You know, I really don't need to know the mating rituals of every single race.
Exactly.
It just gives tons of information. On the other hand, if I really get into this setting, then maybe I want that information and I don't have to look for supplements or articles on a website or whatever. You know, it has that stuff, you know. You don't have to get into the Forgotten Realms situation where there's just so much stuff out there and people want more because they want other stuff detailed. Mm-hmm. You know, here they've detailed a lot of it for you. And so later on down the road, if you're really into the setting, it'll have that stuff for you. So I think that's both a strength and a weakness, depending on how into the setting you're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when I was reading it, that was one of the thoughts I had is, like, you know, just as a newer DM and as someone just approaching this book, man, you know, I'd like to know this stuff eventually, but if they could just pull it out and give me the basic information first and then that information later, I would have preferred that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I like the fact that it was in there for the groups that want it and the DMs that want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit like a... the heaping plateful problem, right? You go to some restaurant and you're like, I'm going to order something, and you get a huge plateful of things for $5 or whatever it's going to be. And, you know, that is great, but maybe not so great if you are on like a diet, right? You know, depending on where you're approaching from that. Like if you just want to eat a lot of food, then you are all set. And if you maybe don't want to grab so much on that, it might be just overwhelming, you know. But you can always just doggy bag it, you know, and get that stuff later. But, yeah, maybe like Tracy was saying, a little more organization to split out the sort of important, really important, you should know this right now, from the really nice to know, and you might want to know this later content.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, there's just a lot there, so it's a lot to consume, and it's hard to figure out if you're into this thing until you're already a lot of the way through it. And parts of it almost read like somebody writing an anthropology textbook on the setting.
Yeah.
You know? Go ahead.
Definitely felt very scientific at parts.
Right. Yeah, it's all like very academic . All right, so anything else to discuss in terms of the depth of content before we just ask the question of what do we think they could have done to make the product better, or some things that maybe you rubbed us the wrong way? All right, so what rubbed us the wrong way? Quinn, why don't you start?
While I praise a lot of the concepts going on there, I felt the implementation was lacking. The big thing is that if I'm going to get whenever I buy a fourth ed product, whether I'm getting it from WotC or a third party, I expect just because of how fourth ed is made, my expectation as a consumer is that there are basic sort of idioms of the game that are going to be found in the design. So if you're going to add a new class, I expect it to sort of fit in with the rest of the classes in there. I want it to do its own thing, right? I want it to be distinct, but, you know, you can't have, you know, some striker that, you know, marks people instead of does extra damage, right? You know, unless it's using the marking to do extra damage, right? You know, it has to conform to the, you know, stuff of roles and things like that. And the classes take up a pretty large part of the book. And the classes work very differently than anything I'm accustomed to seeing in fourth ed. So it's sort of jarring, and sort of disturbing for me. So with the implementation there, I have some issues with that.
Yeah. And I mean, all the implementation seems to have just a little bit off. You know, I'm used to reading fourth edition stat blocks or monsters or class descriptions or whatever, and it uses a certain kind of language. And almost everything they have at some point just seems – the language seems a little bit off from what I'm using. You know, I can figure out what they meant, but, you know, they're not using the same sort of vernacular that I'm used to seeing, you know, in discussions of fourth edition. The implementation on some things don't embrace the fourth edition design concept, which might be good for some people's games, right? If that's the kind of story you want to tell, that might be fine. But I think all of us here anyway have probably fully embraced the philosophies of fourth edition. At least in my case, that you're right. That rubbed me a little bit the wrong way. Tracy, is there anything else that you think could have been better?
The organization's the big one. I just feel like sometimes they got too detailed in some areas and just totally, like, you lost your signposts of where you were in it. That's the big thing for me, having read it. And some of those pronunciations I have no idea about. It sounds like a silly thing, but it's kind of a big deal for me, at least.
Yeah. Oh. See, pronunciations aren't a big deal to me because it's all fantasy, right? So everybody makes it up as they go.
Anyway. Right.
Well, and beyond what we've already talked about, I guess one of the things, and I guess this goes back to the idea of not embracing fourth edition design concept or philosophies, but one of the things that bothered me a little bit is that in a lot of ways this book is about saying no to your players, you know?
Right.
As DMs, we're often told, you know, say yes to your players, and this one is about saying no. Like, no, you can't play a cleric. No, you can't play an elf, dwarf, dragonborn, or any of the other standard D&D races except human. And even that we're going to change, you know? And then they get rid of all these standard races and then replace them with races that, in terms of story, feel a lot like them anyway. You know, the mechanics are all different.
Yeah, they're supposed to evoke them.
Right. The mechanics are different, but the story is intended to evoke the dwarf and the elf and the eladrin and all that. And it's like, well, maybe they could have just left those races in there then and not reinvented the wheel.
One of them, they say explicitly, like, think of it in terms of this D&D race. And I was just like, well, but then I looked through the rest of them and they don't say that anymore. And I was like, but that's really a gnome and that's really a dwarf. And
yeah,
I don't know.
No, I think that's right. And the other area, and they do that in a lot of ways, right? Classes are restricted. Races are restricted. You know, you've got to use what's in this book and a few things from the player's handbook. But for the most part, you've got to use what's in this book. And then in a similar sort of way, I was excited about the idea of the technology, right? Because Quinn, you'd mentioned that that's going to be the obvious draw to people. But even then, the way they've decided to implement it, and it makes sense with their story, and I think that there's maybe an attempt at some sort of balancing element there. But the whole idea of the disruption kind of just feels like one more really complicated thing to track. Like, you have to, you know, the way the disruption reads mechanically is you have to make a disruption check every round of every encounter to see if technology starts breaking. And then once you figure that out, you've then got to go through and figure out what actually broke. It just seems, you know, at the end of every round, I've got to make five different checks before we can go on to the next round. It just seems like it's going to really slow down things.
Yeah, and it is almost in a sense of sort of like, all right, give me my sword. All right, like, you know, like, give me some basic things that aren't gonna break. You know, I can appreciate the difficulties in balancing technology. I mean, without some sort of breakage or, you know, reliability or reloading kind of thing, really, are you ever going to use a sword as opposed to a plasma pistol.
Right. There's a reason, right? That, like, a reason, you know, that swords went out of style, you know, because the technology.
Exactly. Right. It's very hard to make those compete with their. So I can definitely appreciate the tech. I can appreciate the difficulty in that while agreeing with you on the disruption.
Right.
And not wanting to sort of add that extra bookkeeping.
Yeah. And I was waiting to, you know, because they talk about disruption a lot through the whole thing. And I was waiting to get to those rules as I was reading through it and waiting to see how they were going to pull it off. And then I got to it. It's like, oh, that seems like a lot of work. I just think I'd not do that in my game, you know, if I was running an Amethyst game. That just seems like way too much bookkeeping. You know, or everybody's going to play the, whatever that gnome race is because they ignore disruption. So.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. And I think better would be not to get too much into the comparison game or like, why weren't you more, you know, why aren't you more like your older brother kind of scene in it. But what would be great to see is the Dark Sun breakage rules, something similar for technology, for the disruption rules or for the breakage rules. Where you get to, if for anybody who's not familiar with it, basically what they do for the breakage rule in short is you roll one and you're allowed to actually re-roll if you choose. But if you have a certain kind of weapon, it will pretty much break automatically. And if you have a high quality weapon, it'll break if you roll on your next roll a five or lower. So it's sort of this press your luck kind of mechanic, mm-hmm. which is really nice.
Yeah, and I could even go with the older breakage mechanic of if you roll a one, it breaks. And I think I would kind of be okay with that just because it would be simpler to remember and to implement.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, and then there's that whole level of widgets, too, that you can go and take apart things that do break and save some widgets to help you fix other things later. Mm-hmm. That also seems like a lot of bookkeeping.
Yeah, it's just – well, I mean, that sort of came off to me sort of like the technology version of ritual components, right? It's just
right.
I've got another 200 gold pieces in widgets. Although I liked there was a description of – I think it was one of the classes that says that, you know, they get just sort of this bag of random widgets that they've always sort of got around. And it reminded me a little bit of the old edition's Dragonlance Kinder. And then, you know, they've always just sort of got a pouch of Kinder stuff. You know, whatever it is, random stuff they've stolen, as long as it's not particularly useful mechanically, they can just sort of say they've got random little junk in their bag.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I actually liked it, but...
All right. Well, I guess that's our take on Amethyst. I feel like the book is going to be really good if you want to play the very specific type of game that Amethyst is designed for. You know, it's packed with enough information that you can get everything you need out of it for quite some time with just one purchase. But it is a very specific type of game. And if you're not looking to play that very specific type of game, then this may not be the book for you. Does that sound fair?
Sounds fair.
Yeah.
Any other last-minute thoughts before I toss it over to the interview?
I don't know if they're... Are they looking to do follow-ups? I guess this might be off. Right? Do you know if they're doing follow-ups on this, or are they just planning to do this one book?
I have no idea, but I just typed it into my list of questions.
Okay. Well, regardless, you know, I mean, I would love to if they do follow-ups on this. I would love to see some of the concepts tightened up. I would love to. Again, I think the concept has great promise, but the implementation just leaves me cold. You know, I think if you're playing that specific game, like you're saying, then it's good. But you know, it's like I tend to like worlds where I've got more wiggle room, and I'm going to take this stuff and do some cool things with it. But it's definitely good. I like it best for inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think
that's good. On world creation and some concepts.
Well, and I think that I almost wish, as you were saying that, are they doing follow-ups and they could tighten up this and that and whatever. And then I started thinking about Pathfinder, right? And I started thinking, you know, it would have been really cool if they'd have released this sort of like Pathfinder did in beta. you know, if this was the beta document, mm-hmm. and we could all sort of look right. through it and play it and test it and then get back to them and say, well, this works and this doesn't, and that's not the game we're looking for and that kind of thing. And then they came out with, you know, the final version later. That would be really cool. But I'm pretty sure this is the final product, so.
Yeah, because I think, like, some of the locations and stuff are pretty, you know, could provide a lot of inspiration, too. Definitely from the images just themselves, which, as we said earlier, the artwork was great. But, yeah, it needs to be tightened up a little.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like we've summarized Amethyst in a nutshell. There's a lot there that we didn't talk about, but, of course, like we said, in terms of content, it's a really dense book. It's got a lot of stuff in it, so... there's a lot of intriguing story there and some mechanical elements we'd like to see them tightened up. Now I'm going to go ahead and toss it over to myself and my chat with Chris Diaz, author of the book. All right, and now I am here with Chris Diaz of Diaz Ex Machina, the company who wrote and produced Amethyst. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, and thank you for pronouncing the name right.
I worked hard at it. We had, I think...
Well, yeah, people get the... Yeah.
We had a good...
Well, it's the Machina.
Yeah, oh. I'd say we had a good 30-second conversation about pronunciations just before I hit record there, so that was helpful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Deus Ex Machina, based on Deus Ex Machina, which some people have problems figuring out.
Well, I suppose that's a better name than Chris Ex Machina, because that wouldn't have made as much sense.
Yeah, well... Yeah, that would have been totally not vain.
Right.
I am in the machine, yeah.
So anyway, we're here to talk about Amethyst. What is Amethyst? What's your take? What is
How did it begin, or what? How do I define it?
If you were to tell somebody, you know, if somebody were to come up and say, oh, you wrote Amethyst, what is that? You know, caught them on the street or in an elevator or something, you know, what? What do you tell them? How do you pitch what the book is to them?
I would say it's a philosophical science fiction fantasy that tries to present a world, a realistic world, where fantasy and technology are occupying the same space and disrupt each other's existence. So unlike something like Harry Potter or Narnia, where the fantasy world is divided by a door, a train, or a world like War Machine, where they mix and coexist in some way, this actually tries to present a world, a real world, with all of our social, religious problems intact. And how would a fantasy world invading our world truly be accepted? Would it be accepted? Would it be, would it be considered an invasion? And how would we react? Unlike other stories and settings, this one is a techno fantasy where magic actually disrupts technology, so you can't have both. You have to choose either between your dragons, your elves, and your spells, or your refrigerators, your cable TV, your internet, your medical science. You can't have both. And that's it tries to offer a real presentation of what would actually happen if something like this would occurred.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty good description. You take a very robust sort of... description of the setting as you go through the various parts, and I sort of get that idea that you were aiming for a level of realism that most game books don't necessarily try to discuss.
Well, it does actually present. There's actually several little fluff points in the story where people actually acknowledge that this is not a fictionalized version of Earth. It's actually our world. It's the world where Lord of the Rings, Dungeons and Dragons actually exists. And one person actually says that. This is not like a computer game or a bunch of teenagers around a table rolling dice. This is real. You're going to get your butt kicked if you go out there. It's not for the faint-hearted, right?
Mm-hmm. Good. So what was the inspiration for Amethyst? How did this concept come to you?
Well, it didn't come out – it wasn't fully formed like Athena from the head of Zeus, right? It started back in 1992 with an idea I had. It was called Amethyst, but it was not. It was just dragons in a post-apocalyptic setting. About 5 years later, the film Reign of Fire came out, and I got very angry and I threw it on the fire pit and basically forgot about it until 3.5 D&D came out, and a friend of mine, Chris Brown, contacted me and he wanted to get back into D&D. And I dusted off this idea, threw all the fantasy elements into it. But it was still a traditional techno-fantasy where these two worlds collided. And it wasn't until I was talking with another friend and I was telling him about the setting. And I heard myself say, oh, this is a world where these two worlds don't mix, which was true. But then I said, and they actually disrupt each other, which didn't exist until I said that to him. And then I went back into the game and retconned this massive story thread that said these two worlds actually didn't, they actually disrupted each other's existence. And then we had this, over a course of 5, 6, 7 years of developing this through continuous role-playing and campaigns, this started to mutate into what it is now, into this setting, which does actually have these bastions of these cities, which are the last kind of areas of technology left, surrounded by this encroaching ocean of magic. And so it wasn't just one big catharsis I had and I wanted to create it. It has been quite literally nearly a 15 to 16 year process to get Amethyst to its current state. Even the 3.5 game was about 60 to 65% of what I wanted it to be. The fourth edition game is closer to 85 to 90. The novel I'm writing is 100. So it's, you have to make certain concessions when you're creating the role-playing game. It's almost like I'm almost acknowledging my cliches when I create it for a role-playing game. So it seems to be making fun of itself. It's almost a parody of a fantasy game as well as being a fantasy game.
Mm-hmm. So the game was not originally designed with fourth edition in mind.
Well, no, originally it was a screenplay back when I was in, I was trying to be a screenwriter. Oh, okay. And I wrote this fantasy, and then it got turned into a 3.5 game. We put out the 3.5 game. This is, you want to talk about fantastic timing. The 3.5 game came out in April of 2008 after a year and a half of us working on this, basing it off of the OGL and D20 Modern OGL. And then it came out, and then a month later, fourth edition came out. So we got number four on sales in RPG Now the week it came out. We got fantastic reviews and we were doing fantastic for about 30 days. And then fourth edition came out and it was like, who are you again? But the big difference with other games and other game companies, I think, is that we were so new, we decided, what the hell, let's do it. Let's go to fourth edition. We read the rules and we realized we could use the stricter regulations with the GSL to our favor by making the game more original. Because if we could use goblins and use elves, we would use their elves. But since we realized we couldn't, we could create more original creations, which allows Amethyst to be more original. So that started off that long two-year process. And then Goodman Games called us up in July, just after we announced we were going to create a fourth edition, and said, hey, I like what you're doing. Let's publish it in print. And I promptly took my jaw off the floor and said, yeah, sure, okay, seemed like a good idea. Little did I know it would take another year and a half to produce the final product. I mean, we had the first draft done in 2008 before Player's Handbook 2, Player's Handbook 3, or most of these erratas came out. Mm-hmm. So once we read all these, sometime in January of this year, we went back and fixed a lot and tweaked the game a little bit to make it more balanced. So
now, other third-party products use a lot more of what you're allowed to use. You can play elves and fight goblins in other third-party products. Why did you choose to go the route of sort of reinventing all of this for the setting?
Well, because when we created the setting, we created our own elvish races. We created our own goblins and our own monsters. And we liked the way ours worked within the setting. When you deal with their definitions of goblin, there are certain presumptions that go along with it, and that didn't mesh well with what we wanted to create. We had these ideas for these pugs, these bogs, these pagus. We didn't want to use their orc, but if you use their orc, you have to use that then the entire orc. You can't do it piecemeal. You have to do the whole thing.
Right.
So when we looked at it, and we said, well, we can easily use their orc, right, and just call it Pegas, or we can create Pegas on our own. And we much preferred that because then we can make Pegas exactly how we wanted it to look. We can make bogs, not goblins, but exactly how we wanted them to look. So that's the reason why we ended up doing that. With the Elvish race, it's the same way. I didn't like their definition as of elves per se. We have three or four different types of elves, and we wanted to present our elves. So we wanted our scholar elves, Damascans, our kind of sky elves, Illithidians. So we wanted to present those, even though they are still fey races, they're still elves, but they are basically our definition of what inhabits our setting instead of using their predetermined created races. Like, we didn't want to bring Tieflings or Dragonborn because those just don't exist in our setting. So we figured we might as well replace them all.
Okay.
Except human.
Yeah, and although even human gets a bit of a tweak.
Well, there's tech and human. Basically, we add in a rule because you can add definitions to the GSL. You just can't remove them. You can't modify them would be a better word to say. So we added the disruption rule by saying, and it's not really a rule. We're just saying the fact that you can be a tech and human, which is a human that can use technology, or you can be an ek and human, which is a human that uses magic. And if you're basically born Tekken, and you have to make the conscious decision to wield magic. And once you wield magic, you can't go back, which means the decision is permanent. You can't just hop out of the wall, take a little adventure, cast some spells, and then go back to your cable TV. It's not like an MMO where you can turn the game off and go back to the real world. Once you're out there, you're stuck.
Yeah. Although, if I remember right, there were some mechanics to go back. It just took an exceedingly long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so long it was not realistic in the campaign that a GM or DM would run. Like, it's still there as a possibility, but it's so long, it's doubtful any player character would have his character go through that.
Right. So, you've been playing the game and dealing with the stories and the setting and all that kind of stuff for some time. Is there any stories, short stories that you can sort of tell from the playtesting or from playing the setting yourself that sort of highlight what Amethyst is all about? You know, pick out a favorite character that you want to talk about or whatever.
Well, some of the fluff points mention certain specific names, and these are based on characters that actually existed in the game. We created the first game, so the people you read in the book, people like Aiden Camus and so forth and Misha, these are actually based on real player characters. And Aiden is the perfect example of a type of character in that setting. He's a Tekken human that fell in love with fantasy, loved his online games, and once he found out the hard way that this world, this fantasy world, existed outside, he needed to be part of it. But when he went out there, he realized he sucked at mostly anything he could do. He couldn't wield a sword very well. He wasn't very agile, but he knew books. He was smart, so he went about trying to be a wizard. It took him a very long time to be a wizard because it's not easy to be a wizard because not everyone in the setting can wave a wand. If everyone could, there would be anarchy. So that's basically how it works out. There are tons and tons of settings. I mean, God knows the stories because I've been doing this since 2002 and I've just been running it straight with the same group of people with three different sets of characters. And we just, every 2 years, we start a new game in another time period or another setting and we run a new game with a new story. So there's tons of ideas. Hearts of Chaos, which is the module we put out for Free RPG Day in 2008, that was an example of a storyline where a bunch of Tekkens are asked to go out of their bastion walls into the wilderness of fantasy, find a Tekken general, and find out if he is a threat to the Tekken way of life. If he has turned traitor, then either capture him, arrest him, or kill him. Basically, it's an inspiration of it's called Hearts of Chaos, obviously an homage to Hearts of Darkness, the Joseph Campbell novel, and of course Apocalypse Now. So that's what that was. So there's tons of ideas. There's tons of ideas about the interaction between these two worlds. I mean, I couldn't cite specific incidents that we've had, but because our games are such long stories, if I were to get into one of them, it would take up the entire interview.
Sure. So maybe talk about what kind of person is interested in this – do you think should be interested in this kind of book? Because our sort of – and the audience has already heard the review, but our sort of take of it was it doesn't embrace a lot of fourth edition design, but it has some really interesting story. And for if you're trying to tell a specific kind of story, then this book is good for that. If you're trying to do a different kind of story, then – you know, you don't need Amethyst. But if you're trying to tell an Amethyst style of story, then this book is going to provide what you need. So what kind of person is going to be interested, or what kind of story are we going to be interested in running if we're picking up Amethyst?
Well, there, in my opinion, there were two types of people I was writing it for. The first people, the people that liked the setting, that liked the idea of interacting with both fantasy and technological elements in a setting, and for them to either play fantasy characters or science fiction characters, and then their interaction with the other side. Because there are those, there's no direct war between these two sides. There is a lot of abrasion between the two, and they don't always get along. So sometimes that does involve a lot of conflict, especially with the fanatics on both sides that are willing to do anything, including murder in the thousands, to get to push their agenda. The other one are people who just want to use the rules, the science fiction inspired rules, and homebrew that into their own setting. To do that, they could just ignore the disruption rules, ignore the powers that deal with disruption, and take those four tech and classes, and then literally transfer that over into your own game if you wanted to homebrew your own fantasy science fiction game, or just science fiction game. It's not as effective if you just wanted to create a modern game, because our high-tech weapons are plasma weapons, which you may not want to have. Although there is a two-page chapter at the back which does explain how you can modify the rules to adapt it to different types of settings. But our first priority was to make it work within the setting. But you hit a point, actually, that I've been talking with a lot of people recently about, is that we did not write Amethyst to, quote-unquote, follow the design philosophy of 4th edition. Mm-hmm. I didn't think we were obligated to do that. And because we just came off of 3.5, and no one followed the design philosophy of 3.5 when they made games like Midnight. Midnight doesn't follow the design philosophy of 3rd edition rules. Mm-hmm. So we didn't feel we were obligated. So I didn't think we had to assign Defender to a class. We made the class, and then we said, well, he's a bit of Defender and a bit of Controller. We didn't feel that we were ironclad to say, it has to be this, it has to be that. We created these four classes to enmesh with each other, and as a group of four characters, as we've tested them, they work really well off each other. It forces players to be much more of a cohesive team unit, and if they walk around the battle independently, like fantasy characters, they won't survive very long. It takes a different mindset to play the science fiction classes in Amethyst. And we've had people who said they did this battle and they completely killed all their Tekken players. And then we would do the same battle, and then we would completely defeat the enemy without very few casualties on our side. And so it depends on the mindset of the players.
Yeah.
But I think it should attract...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on. No, I was done.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that there's a different mindset, a different philosophy, like you're talking about, that the book and the design does embrace. And it just takes somebody a little bit of extra time who's used to playing 4th edition to come into this game, which looks a lot like 4th edition. But you have to think a little bit differently about it, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, we did push the game by saying initially that technically the Tekken characters are not designed to enmesh or intermingle with the fantasy classes. They can, but the game setting itself is presented to be difficult. So if it's hard in the setting for a science fiction or modern person to basically intermingle with the fantasy, the mechanics also reflect that. Well, if you have a grounder, he is really useful if he has a marshal next to him. But you take the grounder and you put him into a fantasy group, he's not a very effective defender on his own. He becomes more predominantly a controller. He needs that marshal next to him to have his defender qualities. And so these Tekken characters are designed to basically enmesh with each other. So when you pluck them out, they don't work very well with a fantasy group. They'll still work, and my current game does exactly that. I have one Tekken and a group of Ekans, and he seems to do just fine. But it does require a different mindset. It does require more teamwork to play a Tekken party. Right away, we had a battle just yesterday, and two of the Tekken guys never played before. The first thing they did was one guy wanted to hide, one guy wanted to wait until the enemy got up close. And I had to pause the game and said, guys, you realize you have a weapon that has a 40 range, right? You can shoot these guys from a distance, and I think that's a good idea, especially since you have firearms. If these guys get too close, you're going to get your ass kicked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it does require a slight different mentality going into it. You have to think more like a military unit than a fantasy group when you're all basically doing your own little battles. right? Sometimes people will flank each other, but in a Tekken group, all four guys have to be basically in communication with each other.
I think that's some good sort of information to help people understand what the book's about and how to sort of approach it to understand it better. Is there?
I mean, if I go back to it, sorry about that.
Go ahead.
If I go back to it, if I had to do it over, I think I probably would have presented them a bit more traditional. But there was a point where I wanted to tell people that I'm trying to do something different. I'm trying to say, look, I could have copy and pasted the Rangers Hunters quarry ability over, but sometimes we're trying to think outside the box, which is the reason why we have attack powers that do no damage. We have attack powers that take a minor action. If we're trying to play with different ideas and different trains of thought and not just repeating the same patterns that people are used to. Mm-hmm. So, and that was our intent, but a lot of people did criticize us for taking these chances and taking these risks. Sure. And sometimes it worked really, really well. Right? People love our weapons. Nobody has ever complained about our weapons. Our firearm rules are fantastic. I love the explosive rules.
Yeah, I think the equipment, as I agree, tends to come off really well. And I guess that's just sort of what happens when you take a risk, right? Sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't. That's what a risk is.
I'm surprised people haven't nailed us on our vehicle rules, because our vehicle rules are very risky and they do take you out of a lot of the fourth edition design philosophy. Mm. In the same case with explosives, there are no real powers related to explosives. We're going to have that in the second book, but there are no powers related to explosives. It depends entirely on what you've bought and your skills. So it depends entirely of how you plant your explosives and not powers you might have that'll help you. We're going to include powers in the next book, but the explosive rules were co-created by a guy that actually works for the Department of Defense Explosive Ordnance Division. So I was pretty happy we got that stuff right.
Mm-hmm. Good. So you mentioned something there that was in one of my other questions here is follow-up books. What can we expect?
Well, the first book only goes into Canada and America, goes into Canem, North America. Now, people who read the 3.5 knows that even that book covered more. That book covered South America as well. We don't deal with epic tiers in this book. We don't have a lot of monsters above that above level 21. And the original setting does have the entire planet covered. We do actually have the entire planet covered. Mm-hmm. So, yes, absolutely. I'd want to. The second book's already about 70-80% done. It has more Paragon paths, all the epic destinies, foundation spells, which we've mentioned in the book but never actually detailed. They're in there. I want to include at least one or two more Tekken classes. We haven't defined which one that's going to be yet. We were talking about it just yesterday. So we do have an idea for a book, but a lot of it's going to depend on the success of Amethyst. Mm-hmm. Because obviously this is our poster child. This is our attempt to make a stake in the field.
Right, yeah. And I think you even took a very interesting approach you took some risks in terms of how to present the setting as well, because of that focus you have on Can-Am. I think a different group of writers would have taken the approach of, well, let's just sort of skim the whole world, and then if it's popular, we'll get into details later. And you took the idea of, well, no, let's give them something really dense and detailed in one part of the world now, and then we can get to the rest of it later.
I wanted the setting to unfold per book. I didn't want the GM to have his experience with reading the game ruined by knowing too much. I wanted the GM, the DM, to have as much joy reading the book and having questions and knowing that all these questions would be answered. And he could play with that little sandbox that we've created and give him all the information for that little tiny area. And then with the next book, we'll go, oh, you didn't realize there was this other sandbox nearby. Like some fans who've read the 3.5 go, are you going to mention the Saints anytime soon? And I go, shh, don't mention the Saints. They're hardly even mentioned in the first book. People go, Saints? What are Saints? I go, oh, don't worry about the Saints. They're not going to be in the second book, but they are huge in the second book. There are other factions that haven't been mentioned, other bastions that haven't been talked about, whole other regions of the planet that haven't opened up. Mm-hmm. And as we go into the story, you realize there's actually a lot more to that setting than just this one kind of MacGuffin quest of Amethyst. There's actually a lot more at stake than just the fate of just these two types of ideologies.
Cool. So
kind of the way the World of Darkness did theirs.
Yeah, yeah, and it sort of it almost begs for some sort of adventure path or campaign to come out, you know, to sort of tell those stories through the adventures.
Well, I think the second book will also touch on that, as well as opening up a larger region. We'll offer more of these artifacts where they are and offer hopefully dozens of little mini adventures that you can encounter along your own custom created quest.
Mm-hmm. Good. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that the artwork in the book is a high point. I mean, the artwork is fantastic all throughout.
Yeah,
And I'm think proud of that. I think you mentioned that there's one person who did most of the artwork.
Yeah, when we first started, I went looking around for a whole bunch of artists online. I went to GFX, I went to a few others, Epilogue, I think, looking around for artists back when this was just a homebrew game, and I would just kind of grab examples of their artwork and say, okay, this is what this place looks like, this is what this place looks like, and when I started to actually do Amethyst as a professional publication, I went to these artists that I was using for inspiration and said, do you want to do original work? Initially, we had about a dozen guys. Schedules brought it down to 3 or 4. Some of them worked better than others. When we did the 4th edition, only one person emerged, and that was Nick Greenwood. And the reason why Nick was so strong, he was beyond the fact that he does black and white artwork like nobody I've ever seen. He does fantastic color, but he is so interactive. I give him a brief description of ideas. I give him a little bit of inspiration. I describe things in detail, and he gets it every single time. There's very few times I ever send back a piece that say, this is not exactly where we're going. And even if I do, he'll just throw the whole thing out and do it all over. He is such a perfectionist. Like, some artists will do it, they'll hand it in, and I go, well, this is not exactly what I want. And they'd be like, well, you're not paying me enough for that, right? But this, he was absolutely adamant in getting 100% everything perfect. He'd give me a dozen sketches. And, okay, well, choose which one you like. And I'd be like, well, unfortunately, I like them all. I mean, that's his way of making more money off of me, because he'll just give me 4 sketches and go, which one do you like? And I'd be like, well, I got to take all 4 of them. And that's how he, you know, he did that. He did that with races. He did that with the technology. I have so many awesome sketches that we did not have a chance to squeeze into this book that's going to go into the next book. Unbelievable stuff he puts out. And he still puts it out. I mean, he's not even on the payroll anymore, and he still sends me sketches. I have an idea of this for a power armor. Yeah, I'll buy that. And he's working on the Earth's Path, so I'm just constantly working nonstop. He's a godsend. He's fantastic. And like I said, he's in your neck of the woods.
Yeah. So how did you – so you found him just at a convention then?
No, not even at a convention. I saw him online. He did some really good black and white artwork on some work for, oddly enough, Goodman Games. And I approached him and said, you know, are you interested in working, doing some work for us? He was one of the few guys that even did black and white. And that was one of the biggest reasons, I'll be honest with him and with you. He was one of the few that actually would do black and white. Most of these guys won't do black and white. They'll just do color. He was very competitive. And not only that, after we started getting his sketches, and I started seeing the first initial race sketches, which is the first things he did, the Narrows, the Gimfen, the Damascan, and I was floored. Actually, initially I saw these sketches. I went, wow, these are pretty good finals. And he was like, those aren't the finals. No, right? And then he gave me the finals. And I was like, wow. we would gather together, watch these, and we'd be stunned silence at the quality of this guy. And every once in a while, I'll look at the artwork and go, how the hell did we get this guy? How did we get this? It was fate. I'm not a religious guy. He is, so he can. It was fate. He loves working with the project. I love working with him. He is fantastic. And we've had developed a really good relationship. And I think that's why I probably get the absolute highest quality artwork, because I have an artist that is as enthusiastic about the project as we are. And as a result, wants to put out the highest quality stuff he can. And he's fantastic as a result of that. I cannot praise him enough. Well, if anything, people can buy the book for the artwork.
I say, get as much work out of him as you can before somebody with a bigger payroll snatches him away.
I think we passed that point with him. Actually, I think that he's with us because of his love of the setting.
He likes the product.
He likes the product. Likes the strength of it. I mean, he was with us when it was a 3.5 self-published book on Lulu.
Yeah.
Right. So he's grown with us as we've been professionally published now. So great. No, I think I got the hooks firmly in his flesh.
Well,
I think he's hooked.
Him.
I will.
All right. Well, I think that's all I've got for you now. So I wanted to say thanks for coming on.
No problem. Well, thanks for the interview.
Yeah, it's an interesting book, and I think there's definitely a story to be told here, and I look forward to seeing more of it because I'm not familiar with the 3-5 stuff. So,
well, like I said, if you are interested, I'd be happy to send you a copy of that. I think fourth edition is a bit better written. It's more solid, and I'm also hoping if people do have criticism or critiques, or they want to make the product better, go to dsxmachina.com, go to the forums, and post your concerns. I mean, we're collating all this information from fans who love the product, love what it's trying to do, and right now there's nothing out there that's putting out science fiction modern rules. So if we can help make the product better, come on down and let us know, because we are listening and we are working on it, and if we can make the product more compatible to all your interests, then so much the better. I am a corporate whore. I will do anything to sell my books.
All right. And with that, we'll say goodbye. All right. That has been episode 137. I want to thank our sponsor, FRP Games, as well as our guests, Chris Diaz. Tracy, thank you for coming on, as well as Quinn. Where can we find you guys over on the internet?
Well, you can find me at sarahdarkmagic.com and on Twitter as sarahdarkmagic.
Despite the fact that you are not actually Sarah.
Yes. It was the first name of my first character ever.
And Quinn, you can be found at?
You can find me at 4E at Will, as they can actually find you oftentimes, Jeff.
More and more these days, yeah.
More and more these days, writing some great stuff over at the blog. So come check the both of us and the rest of the team over at 4eatwill.net. And also, you can follow my crazy fourth ed-ridden adventures on Twitter. My name is Game Fiend.
All righty. Well, and you can always reach me by email at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums. And in fact, I've sort of decided just last minute here I think Amethyst has some great potential, but I have both a PDF review copy and a physical review copy that I got from Goodman Games because I wanted to make sure, you know, the physical product was in good shape. And it is. It's, you know, in terms of physical product, it comes off well. And it's a nice hardbound book. And I've just decided right here and now that I'm going to give it away, assuming that Goodman Games tells me I can. So I'm going to give it away to anybody who goes over to the forums at vorpalnetwork.com and posts in the thread that I'm going to create about why you're interested in running Amethyst. And let's say you've got till the end of June to do it. How's that sound?
Good.
Sounds good.
All right. So you can also review the show on iTunes or tell people about it. That helps get the word out and helps spread the audience. Don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed in the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 137, where we have successfully dodged the minions of Ixandar and avoided the disruption of the Ekan world on the Tekken machines, like the ones we're using to record this review of Amethyst of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.